And now he was president and faced the press and faced May Craig with funny hats. And the president gave her funny answers.
Mr. President, the practice of managed news is attributed to your administration. Mr. Salinger says he's never had it defined. Will you give us your definition and ask us why you find it necessary to practice it?
You are charging us with something, Miss Crane, and you're asking me to define what it is you're charging me with. I think you might let me just say that we've had very limited success in managing the news, if that's what we've been trying to do. And perhaps you'd tell us what it is that you object to in our treatment of the news.
Are you asking me, sir?
Yes.
Well, I don't believe in managed news at all. I thought we ought to get everything we want.
Well, I think you should, too, Miss Gray. I'm for that.
Mr. President, the Defense Department announcement on the incident in the Florida Straits said simply that the MiGs fired near the shrimp
boat. Correct.
And you used the term attack. Now, did these MiGs attack the boat and miss, or did they harass the boat?
I don't think we have the answer to that question. I think the shots came within, 40 yards of the boat. I would think if you're on the boat, that's regarded as an attack. And whether they were trying to hit the boat or whether they were merely attempting to target practice, all these things, I think we'll have to look at the next day or so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The youthful and vigorous President of the United States impresses one and all, particularly the members of the Women's National Press Club, as he comments personally about the economy of lunch.
First, the sudden and arbitrary action of the officers of this organization in increasing the price of dinner tickets by $2.50 over last year constitutes a wholly unjustifiable defiance of the public interest. If this increase is not rescinded, but is imitated by the gridiron, radio, TV, and other dinners, it will have a serious impact on the entire economy of this city. In this serious hour in our nation's history, when newsmen are awakened in the middle of the night to be given a front page story, when expense accounts are being scrutinized by the Congress, when correspondents are required to leave their families for long and lonely weekends at Palm Beach, the American people will find it hard to accept this ruthless decision made by a tiny handful of executives. Whose only interest is the pursuit of pleasure. I am hopeful that the Women's Press Club will not join this price rise and will thereby force a rescission.
Undoubtedly, one of the Kennedy legacies, which will live for many years, is the Peace Corps. The young men and women of America came from farms and cities to work in faraway places for insignificant sums to lend their efforts to peoples of other countries on a person-to-person, a student-to-student, a farmer-to-farmer program.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a Peace Corps on a temporary pilot basis. This corps will be a pool of trained men and women sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health. I'm hopeful that it will be a source of satisfaction to Americans and a contribution to world peace.
Under President Kennedy, the people of America turned their eyes to space seriously and significantly.
We have a long way to go in the space race. We started late, but this is the new ocean, and I believe the United States must sail on it and be in a position second to none.
17 years ago today, a group of Marines put the American flag on Mount Suribachi. So it's very appropriate that today we decorate Colonel Glenn of the United States Marine Corps, and also realize that in the not-too-distant future, a Marine or a Naval man or an Air Force man will put the American flag on the moon.
And then, in a new effort to win friends and influence people, to suggest and aid and assist, the president developed his Alliance for Progress.
Yet our basic goal remains the same, a peaceful world community of free and independent states, free to choose their own future and their own system, so long as it does not threaten the freedom of others. Some may choose forms and ways that we would not choose for ourselves, but it is not for us that they are choosing. We can welcome diversity the communists cannot, for we offer a world of choice, and they offer a world of coercion. And the way of the past shows clearly that freedom, not coercion, is the wave of the future. At times, our goal has been obscured by crisis or endangered by conflict, but it draws sustenance from five basic sources of strength: the moral and physical strength of the United States, the united strength of the Atlantic community, the regional strength of our hemispheric relations, the creative strength of our efforts in the new and developing nations, and the peacekeeping strength of the United Nations. Arms alone are not enough to keep the peace. It must be kept by men. Our instrument and our hope is the United Nations, and I see little merit in the impatience of those who would abandon this imperfect world instrument because they dislike our imperfect world. For the troubles of a world organization merely reflect the troubles of the world itself, and if the organization is weakened, these troubles can only increase. We may not always agree with every detailed action taken by every officer of the United Nations or with every voting majority, but as an institution, it should have in the future, as it has had in the past since its inception, no stronger or more faithful member than the United States of America.
One of the president's most important liaison officers, possessed of linguistic ability, diplomatic understanding, youth and beauty.
Madre y padre y familia en este continente que pueda conformarse hasta que los habitantes de todos nuestros pueblos tengan oportunidades de trabajo bien remunerado, puedan vivir decentemente y recibir enseñanza. Estas cosas deberían estar al alcance de todos y no limitarse a unos pocos afortunados.
The courage of the man revealed itself in the Cuban crisis. It's evident, his determination, as he faces the people of America and spells out the facts of life.
Only last Thursday, as evidence of this rapid offensive buildup was already in my hand, Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko told me in my office that he was instructed to make it clear once again, as he said his government had already done, that Soviet assistance to Cuba, and I quote, pursued solely the purpose of contributing to the defense capabilities of Cuba, unquote. Neither the United States of America nor the world community of nations can tolerate deliberate deception and offensive threats on the part of any nation, large or small. We no longer live in a world
where only the actual firing of weapons represents a sufficient challenge to a nation's security to constitute maximum peril. Nuclear weapons are so destructive, and ballistic missiles are so swift, that any substantially increased possibility of their use or any sudden change in their deployment may well be regarded as a definite threat to peace. In violation of Soviet assurances and in defiance of American and hemispheric policy, this sudden, clandestine decision to station strategic weapons for the first time outside of Soviet soil is a deliberately provocative and unjustified change in the status quo, which cannot be accepted by this country if our courage and our commitments are ever to be trusted again by either friend or foe. Our policy has been one of patience and restraint, as befits a peaceful and powerful nation which leads a worldwide alliance. We have been determined not to be diverted from our central concerns by mere irritants and fanatics. But now further action is required, and it is underway, and these actions may only be the beginning. We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. Should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities. Third, it shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. Fourth, as a necessary military precaution, I have reinforced our base at Guantanamo, evacuated today the dependents of our personnel there, and ordered additional military units to be on a standby alert basis. Fifth, we are calling tonight for an immediate meeting of the Organization of Consultation under the Organization of American States. Sixth, under the Charter of the United Nations, we are asking tonight that an emergency meeting of the Security Council be convoked without delay to take action against this latest Soviet threat to world peace. Our resolution will call for the prompt dismantling and withdrawal of all offensive weapons in Cuba under the supervision of UN observers before the quarantine can be lifted. Seventh and finally, I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace and to stable relations between our two nations. I call upon him further to abandon this course of world domination and to join in an historic effort to end the perilous arms race and to transform the history of man. We are prepared to discuss new proposals for the removal of tensions on both sides, including the possibilities of a genuinely independent Cuba, free to determine its own destiny. We have no wish to war with the Soviet Union, for we are a peaceful people who desire to live in peace with all other peoples. But it is difficult to settle or even discuss these problems in an atmosphere of intimidation. That is why this latest Soviet threat, or any other threat, which is made either independently or in response to our actions this week, must and will be met with determination. Any hostile move anywhere in the world against the safety and freedom of peoples to whom we are committed, including in particular the brave people of West Berlin, will be met by whatever action is needed. My fellow citizens, let no one doubt that this is a difficult and dangerous effort on which we have set out. The path we have chosen for the present is full of hazards, as all paths are. But it is the one most consistent with our character and courage as a nation and our commitments around the world. The cost of freedom is always high, but Americans have always paid it. And one path we shall never choose, and that is the path of surrender or submission. Our goal is not the victory of might, but the vindication of right. Not peace at the expense of freedom, but both peace and freedom here in this hemisphere, and we hope around the world. God willing, that goal will be achieved.
The communist counterpoint continued to operate, Cuba and then Berlin. President Kennedy addresses himself to the wall, a divided city, but a united people.
Is there any feeling on your part that what happened in Cuba has led to greater caution in Berlin insofar as the Soviet and East German governments are concerned?
Well, I think the chairman, nobody wants to go through what we went through in Cuba very often, and I think they realize that West Berlin is a vital interest to us and that we're committed there and that we're going to stay there. On the other hand, he has a very vital interest in East Germany and trying to prop up that regime and trying to solidify his position in Eastern Europe. So Berlin is a dangerous position always, particularly because of its geography, because we have to keep communications to an area which is 120 miles behind their lines. So this always gives him a chance to tighten the grip on our windpipe there. But I think he may proceed with some care, because I think he realizes it's the combination of a vital interest and one which has the chance of a direct encounter. So that I think that, as I say, Mr. Khrushchev's speech showed that he knows, and those who are attacking Mr. Khrushchev in the communist camp, particularly the Chinese, as being too soft, I think Mr. Khrushchev realizes the care with which he must proceed now, as do we.
But time was running out for the youthful president. Rested from a Florida visit, he undertook a fence-mending trip to the state of Texas. This is what he said in Houston.
Governor, Mr. Vice President, Senator, members of the Congress, members of the military, ladies and gentlemen, for more than 3 years, I've spoken about the new frontier. This is not a partisan term, and it's not the exclusive property of Republicans or Democrats. It refers instead to this nation's place in history, to the fact that we do stand on the edge of a great new era, filled with both crisis and opportunity, an era to be characterized by achievement and by challenge. It is an era which calls for action, and for the best efforts of all those who would test the unknown and the uncertain in every phase of human endeavor. It is a time for pathfinders and pioneers. I have come to Texas today to salute an outstanding group of pioneers. The man who manned the Brooks Air Force Base School of Aerospace Medicine and the Aerospace Medical Center.
The final smile. The final meal. The last goodbye. Within 2 hours, he would be dead.
Next month, when the United States of America fires the largest booster in the history of the world into space for the first time, giving us the lead, fires the largest payload into space, giving us the lead, it will be the largest payroll, too. Who should know that better than Houston? In 1990, your sons, daughters, grandsons, and grandchildren will be applying to the colleges of this state in a number 3 times what they do today. Our airports will serve 5 times as many passenger miles. We will need housing for 100 million more people, and many times more doctors and engineers and technicians than we are presently producing. That is why we're trying to do more in these areas. As in the 30s, Albert Thomas and Franklin Roosevelt and others did those things which make it possible for not only Texas, but the entire United States to prosper and grow as we do in the 1960s. In 1990, the age of space will be entering its second phase, and our hopes in it to preserve the peace, to make sure that in this great new sea, as on Earth, the United States is second to none.
His life ended as abruptly as his Dallas speech. It was a portent of the hour ahead. He was the brave architect of the new frontier. He charted its course into areas previously unexplored. Civil rights, Peace Corps, foreign aid, education. He infused with strength all he touched. Vigor became a word to be reckoned with, the hallmark of his administration and his life. It is his legacy. Remember Robert Frost's words at the president's inauguration? And miles to go before I sleep. Too few. And now, no more.